Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 15th, 2006. Our session today is entitled Creative Incentives for Business to Act Responsibly, Part 2. Our presenter is Steve Balls. Session number BAHS 2006-2. Let's listen in.
Session on corporate responsibility. My name is Steve Balls. I currently serve as president of Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois. Well, so good to see you all here as I think about corporate responsibility and think about how we encourage the economic engine of the world, corporations and multinational corporations, to be responsible, create jobs, create opportunities for people. It is every discipline that is represented here that is an important part of that, whether it be pastors, law, doctors, citizens, you name it. We're swimming upstream, in my opinion, in encouraging corporations to, well, at the same time as maximizing a profit, to act responsibly. Last night we kind of teed up the problem. And today I'd like to talk about solutions to the problem. The problem, of course, last night we talked about the regulatory environment relating to a business. We talked about the United States standing alone, really, with Great Britain in its view that corporations are a contract between the individual shareholders and the corporation. The United States and Great Britain stand alone among economic powers to say that the major purpose, or the sole purpose, according to some court cases, of a corporation is to maximize profits to shareholders. Now, we talked about the regulatory framework for corporations changing a bit. That is, the majority of the states adopting what we call constituency statutes that corporate managers may take into account other constituencies and stakeholders, take into account the interest of employees, take into account the interest of communities, take into account the environment, may, so long as those interests are parallel with the best interest of the corporation. We talked a little bit about some of the case law in that regard, that corporate managers may act responsibly and have a defense against shareholder suits, that you're not maximizing profits, and take into account ethical considerations, so long as those ethical considerations are generally accepted by the business community. So, in terms of protecting other stakeholders in corporations, what are they? The environment, employees, the public, international, the community, in the case of multinational corporations, creditors, you name it, it is a little difficult. We talked about a hypothetical last night, which is, I think, an interesting one. What if a corporate manager of a manufacturing corporation that complies with the environmental laws, so a manufacturing corporation, wants to cut emissions from their factories by 75%. That is not only complying with the law, but cut emissions much more than the law requires. Can they do that? Are they open to a shareholder's suit? Or the shareholders might say you're not maximizing profits. And we hypothesize that to reduce emissions that much in that hypothetical corporation meant the profitability in that corporation would be reduced by 50%. Can a corporation go ahead and do that and be immune from shareholder suit? And we kind of decided under the status of the current law, no, they can't do that because it is not generally accepted among corporate managers as an ethical consideration to cut emissions that much. But we also decided that if they do that, if they would decide to be very socially responsible, what would happen to the stock prices in that corporation? They would go way down, would they not? What would happen when the stock prices went way down? We'd have a corporate raider come in, take over that corporation, buy the stock at a bargain price, throw out management, and probably reverse the decision to act very, very responsibly. So last night we ended on a bit of a negative note. That is, we're swimming upstream, in a sense, if we want corporations to act responsibly, particularly corporations if we desire them to be on the cutting edge of social responsibility. It's easy to be in the fat middle of social responsibility, be good to employees, and so on. Yes, sir.
Where in the law does it say that the corporations are there to maximize the profits to the shareholders?
That is part of the common law associated with corporations. We looked at a case last night where Dodge versus Ford, you'll recall, where the majority shareholder in the Ford Motor Company was Henry Ford. The minority shareholders were the Dodge brothers. Henry Ford said he wanted to... Henry Ford said in 1919 that this corporation's making too much money, that we ought to cut prices of automobiles. He had this novel idea that those that build automobiles ought to be able to afford an automobile. Higher wages, lower prices. The court came back and said the object of a business corporation is to return a profit to shareholders, and ordered Henry Ford not to run Ford as a charitable institution, but to pay higher dividends to the shareholders. So that's not typically found in statutes. It's found in common law. We talked last night that our corporate codes are very different in the United States than any place else in the world. Corporate codes are about 50 pages in most states, if that. There are volumes in other countries regulating many, many aspects of corporate conduct. So the question then is, what can we do to ensure corporate responsibility? Corporate managers may take into account the needs of shareholders, but they need not take into account the needs of shareholders. If they go too far out without the permission of shareholders, they're subject to suit by shareholders, or more realistic, subject to a removal by the market mechanism of a takeover company coming in, taking them over because prices are artificially depressed. Well, I think a lot of people can help ensure corporate responsibility. And I think we have a duty as Christians and as a duty, duty as people of faith to do what we can in that regard. Remember, corporations are unnatural beings, according to the law. That is, they're artificial entities, but they have a lot of rights, certainly rights to own a property, many of the rights of individuals, but they're unnatural individuals. Likewise, remember that multinational corporations can float above the regulations of any individual country. They don't like what happens in one country, they simply move their operations to countries with a laxer view. It is almost a race to the bottom in some developing countries, is it not, to see who can be laxest in their regulation of corporations, because officials there want to create jobs. And to create jobs, sometimes third world countries will look the other way with respect to environmental regulations, labor regulations, and so on. So we're swimming against the current here in many ways in ensuring corporate responsibility. Do we give up? Well, I have reproduced on the second page of the syllabus for those of you who have the handout. I copied the ELCA website and what it says about corporate responsibility. The ELCA has a fairly well-developed corporate responsibility program. Most of the mainline churches do. The Catholic Church does. We're called upon by the church, and I think you're here, most of you, because you believe this call, to believe that it is God's, that in God's business involves all of life, and that God calls the church, both corporately and individually, to use all that is committed to its care, to practice good stewardship in the form of creation, to pursue justice, to care for people in need, and seek things that make for peace. We need to do that in every aspect of our lives. It is my belief. I would simplify it to Micah 6:8. If we had corporate executives all that believed in justice, that loved mercy, and that were humble, I think we would have a better corporate America. Ken Lay, who recently passed away, I believe that at one level he did believe in justice. perhaps at one level he believed in mercy. I don't know whether he was humble, though. The individuals at Enron were not humble in any way. What happened at Enron? Ken Lay was a Methodist, was, I think, a good church a member. If you look at the other executives at Enron, many of them were good church members. Many of them were on boards of community organizations. Many of them were great parents. They coached soccer teams. They were in the Rotary Club. They were community leaders. What happened there?
Sounds like they got greedy.
They got greedy. Many of them gave a lot of it away. They kept a lot of it too, didn't they? I think that what happened in that case was that there was not a lot of humility there. I think that in that case, and I think it's fairly well documented, I mean, it's interesting, there were about 30 core people to that scandal. Finally, someone blew the whistle after the scandal had gone on year after year after year. But it's interesting to me, these were, Bethany McLean wrote a book, The Smartest Guys in the Room, talking about Enron. These were smart guys. They went to the best MBA programs. They really reconceptualized the energy business in a very, very clever way. And they were, many of them, not all of them, great people in the community. How could it happen, being so smart, so ethical? Well, greed is an overwhelming impulse. I think they adopted a set of situational ethics, too, that when they walked through the front door at Enron, they, in fact, adopted a set of ethics that they would not apply to their church, they would not apply to their family, and so on. I have a lot of sadness when I look at Enron and what happened in that regard, because people were not humble. People became drunk with power and greed and so on.
Where does greed become power? Or a search for power as opposed to...
Well, that, you know, that's a great question, and does power always come with greed? I don't think so, but those that are in positions of power are very vulnerable to being consumed by greed. There's no doubt about it. I think Ken Lay actually was a pretty good person, but he could not buck the tide of greed. What did he do? I don't know whether he participated in it directly, but he turned a blind eye to a corporation where he had responsibility not to turn a blind eye, and as such was accountable. What can the various constituencies do to ensure that corporations act responsibly? The market mechanism isn't going to help us out much here unless we are very proactive to use that market mechanism and to shape that market mechanism. The stock market, Adam Smith's invisible hand that is going to value companies appropriately, is not going to ensure corporate responsibility. The law may not ensure corporate responsibility. We talked about last night that really for to ensure responsibility to the various stakeholders, that we need a strong system of regulation, strong labor laws, strong antitrust laws, strong environmental laws, but we know that that process is flawed also. That is, the way that laws are made often contain exemptions, loopholes. Attorneys often find ways to operate within these laws. So we can't operate, we can't assume that the law is automatically going to encourage corporate responsibility. Well, I think there are a number of stakeholders in corporations that can do a lot. What can churches do as institutional beings to help ensure that corporations act responsibly? Any ideas?
They act responsibly with regard to their own investments.
Yeah, let's ask about that. How do you do that? How can churches act responsibly with respect to their own investments?
Church I was at, we looked at you know, various CDs and things that had been bequested, went and met with the bank where that was, asked what their investment policies were. We were hoping that, this is in California, so we were hoping that most of this was being turned over into home loans. Wasn't the case. And so So we asked if they would move our money to that division. They weren't set up that way. So we moved it all to a local credit union that only did home lending.
Church was a knowledgeable investor. Certainly the Lutheran Church is a knowledgeable investor, but the Lutheran Church argues that we ought to be knowledgeable investors. That is hard to do. Actually, I like what the Presbyterian Church has to say about it. On the Presbyterian Church's website, there really is a nice statement about the responsibility of investors. It parallels a bit the Lutheran website, but the Presbyterian website kind of lays it out in bullet fashion. What they suggest is that churches and individuals who are investors have the following responsibilities. A, to screen their investments. That is, to be knowledgeable investors. What are you investing in? There are mutual funds that will help with this. The website points out, you know, many of those funds. Many of the funds have positive screens. By that, they look at corporations that are committed to the social good. What is the social good? Typically, these screens look to environmental stewardship, fair employment practices, if they operate internationally, respect for human rights and the sovereignty of other nations. There are some negative screens, too. Many of the mutual funds have negative screens, and many people argue with those negative screens. Negative screens might include not investing in anything that participates in the production of alcohol, tobacco, ammunitions, gambling, and so on. So that certainly is one thing that we ought to do as investors, that is to be aware of our investment. The second thing that the Presbyterian Church advocates, and also the Lutheran Church, is shareholder advocacy. And we'll talk about that for a minute. What is shareholder advocacy? How can you be effective as a shareholder if you don't, in encouraging a corporation to be socially responsible? And let's assume that you have stock in, let's assume you have stock in Dean Foods, and you're concerned about the environmental record of Dean Foods, and you want Dean Foods to improve its environmental record. What can you do? You own a couple of $1,000s of stock.
Attend shareholder meetings and bring forth resolutions.
Yeah, bring forth resolutions.
I had a question about it. I always think about it. You know, I get my proxy, you know, my thing, and I'm in Sacramento, and there's a meeting in Minneapolis or Atlanta or somewhere, and you know, I just feel absolutely powerless, even though I own shares, to do that.
Well, let's ask about that though. You own a few shares, and you have a concern with the corporation. In fact, maybe you bought a corporate stock because you had a concern about the corporation and you wanted to make a point. How feasible is it for an individual to offer a shareholders a resolution? The meeting is in Atlanta, for example. Yeah. For our attorneys in the group, you can do shareholders resolutions. They're a little tricky on how to do them. There are a number of ways that corporations, businesses, publicly held businesses, can knock these shareholder resolutions out. If they require the corporation to do something you can't require them to do, they can be knocked out. Often, if you require the board of directors to take a specific action, as opposed to ask them to study it, can be knocked out because shareholders don't have the power that the board has. But there are ways to be successful in shareholder resolutions. And I think the SEC, although it ebbs and flows, Securities Exchange Commission, is a little more open to some of these shareholders resolutions these days. They can be knocked out if it's a matter of day-to-day business. But typically a good shareholders resolution is a policy matter, squarely a policy matter that advises the board to look at something that requires public disclosure or a report. But sitting in California with the board meeting in Atlanta, can you be very, very effective in that regard? Well, you need to weave your way through the regulations. It's hard to do without an attorney. It's expensive. You have to fly out to Atlanta. You're going to get hammered probably in the end with respect to the shareholders' resolution. So why do it? Well, we have people to do it for us. That is the good news. The ELCA has sponsored a number of shareholders' resolutions. I think in your materials, I downloaded from the ELCA website specifically what they have done within the last year. That would be in unit number 6, and it's the table. The ELCA is pretty aggressive with respect to shareholders' resolutions. And look at what they've done through their various investments. Asked Avon to talk about a toxic policies report, Bank of America, to avoid predatory loans where you go into marginal neighborhoods, make the loans, and then foreclose on the loans, taking the down payment. Annual elections of directors, sustainability reports, product safety, HIV, AIDS, board diversity. Look what's happened to those shareholders' resolutions that the ELCA has put together in the meetings. A couple of them are pending. Most of them have been withdrawn by the ELCA due to constructive dialogue with the company. One has been challenged by the corporation, that's Marathon Oil, HIV, AIDS, and it says that it was challenged by an SEC, that there's an SEC no action letter on that. I was unable to find that letter when I did a public search of the SEC site, so I can't tell you more about that. My guess was that it was too closely tied to a day-to-day employment practice that it got challenged. But the ELCA knows what it is doing. Each of these resolutions would be voted down. Few, if any, shareholders' resolutions have been passed. When a shareholder's resolution is passed, in almost every case, it's because the pension funds get behind the shareholders' resolutions. And in almost every case, the pension funds get behind shareholders' resolutions that deal with excessive director compensation. So we can be proud of the ELCA. The ELCA cooperates with the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, which coordinates tens, if not 100 or more shareholders' resolutions per year. Jane?
Do some of these companies respond to the sort of the threat or the first steps toward a shareholder resolution by saying, you know, we're really not interested in being in the press over refusing to do this or that. Look, we'll talk. Is that why they get into that? Because they think it'd be better for us to just maybe go ahead and quietly do it, and rather than have a big press thing showing us that we're being irresponsible?
And that's exactly what happened. I've only been involved in filing one shareholder resolution. I mentioned to the people last night, it was on behalf of the Presbyterian Church, and it involved a case, as I said last night, of Alice Chalmers. Alice Chalmers, you recall, manufactured tractors in West Alice, Wisconsin. Alice Chalmers was talking about closing plants. We felt, since a lot of these towns where they had their manufacturing facilities, that the corporation had two duties upon closing a plant. One, to give at least 6 months' notice with respect to plant closures. Two, to form a group to negotiate with the municipalities about, as they leave, cushioning the blow. We submitted a shareholders' a resolution to that effect, that you need to give notice and you need to negotiate in good faith with the community. I would have thought initially that it was the end of the world. You know, here are the 10 reasons why you can't do it and why we're going to challenge it. But in the end, Alice Chalmers said, we'll fly you to New York, you and the other people from the Greater Milwaukee Council of Churches that was working with the Presbyterian Church, and we cut a deal. They didn't want the bad press. The deal we cut was not 180 days notice, but 90 days of notice. Now, in a way, we had no bargaining chips other than the media to make an issue of it. It was going to get hammered at a shareholders meeting. These things always lose. Why do they always lose? Because management controls the proxies, right? They get the shareholders to sign the proxy card, and shareholders almost like blindly sign these proxy cards. They really don't read this stuff. Have you ever read the information you get? Typically, there are shareholders' resolutions for larger corporations. What does management say with respect to the shareholders' resolutions? Vote against it because it decreases management flexibility, decreases management's ability to earn a fair return on the dollar. So they're going to get voted down. But shareholders' resolutions are a very effective way to engage in dialogue. You can't do it yourself. You can do it yourself. There are some shareholders that do it. But through the ELCA, through pension funds and so on, you can do it. And the most active groups with respect to shareholders' resolutions are religious organizations. Pension plans aren't very good at it because pension plans are very interested in having a maximum return so they can meet their pension obligations. What else can churches do? Yes?
I think the most important thing churches can do is to motivate, encourage, and inspire their members to be positive forces as managers, employees, what have you, within the group. It's quite a phenomenon in America where we have lots of Christian people, church-going folks that come to places like Holy, but when they go home, they don't talk about their church in their workplace. And I think simply identifying yourself as a person of faith, as a person who cares about these issues, you can have a significant impact indirectly. And that's how I think the church can be a very powerful force. Corporations don't listen to churches just because a church is saying something, but their members will listen to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're suggesting that the corporation, that the churches can have an influence on corporate managers and employees who are church members. You believe that? Do most of you agree with that? I happen to agree with that, but do most of you? Yes.
I'm thinking of one specific pastor who has within the congregation a CEO of several large corporations that you'd all know the names of if I said. And he makes the point of getting together with those people or bringing them together to talk about these very kind of issues. How do you conduct business in a way that honors all the many obligations that you have on that board? How can you do that? How can you thread it through? How can these leaders support one another in what is admittedly an extremely challenging task?
Yes.
And that's one of the best leverage points, I think, that we have.
Indeed. Indeed. Yes, sir.
On a church, you don't necessarily have all of the managers there, but you certainly everybody in the church is a consumer. So through some education, you can advocate for companies that have fair employment practices or don't use sweatshops
for
producing clothing or that type of advocacy.
I think churches can be at the forefront of the education process, whether it be managers, employees, consumers. I think the Lutheran church, and I suppose most denominations, have a special role to play with respect to managers. We ought to be challenged, all of us, to be asked what our vocation is. Corporate managers ought to be asked, what is your vocational calling? Is your vocational calling to make a maximum of profits to shareholders? Most of them would say no. My vocational calling is to create opportunities through business, to strengthen this world through business. There is so much pressure inside of business, as you know, to focus on the bottom line, particularly publicly held corporations, quarterly reports. And I think church leaders, pastors, have a tremendous opportunity to challenge us all to ask what our vocational calling is and to keep us in mind, because managers can make a difference. As we look at various codes of ethics adopted by managers, top managers of corporations, some of them are very strong codes of ethics. Many of our corporations have signed on to the Global Sullivan Principles. Many of our corporations now have reporting with respect to their sustainability practices and have their sustainability practices audited. Managers have made a tremendous difference, and for those of you who know managers, you can make certainly a significant difference. What about employees? You're not a manager, but you're a rank and file employee in a corporation. Can you make any difference for social responsibility there? What do you think? Not everyone's lucky enough to be a manager, certainly. I think employees can do a number of things. First of all, to use company whistleblower policies. Most companies now have sophisticated whistleblower policies. For the attorneys in the room, if a company retaliates against a whistleblower, what happens? Are they in a world of hurt? They are in a world of hurt. So if you see a corporation with a great code of ethics, not following that code of ethics, certainly as an employee to use that whistleblower policy. No one blew the whistle for many years at Enron Corporation. They were all afraid to blow the whistle, or maybe too greedy to blow the whistle. And it's amazing to me, and almost a sociological study, of how you could have so many people, a core group, 25 or 30, almost all males, incidentally, corrupt for that long without blowing the whistle. Perhaps if we had more diversity within that organization, we might have had different result. It was eventually a woman who blew the whistle. Yes?
Work for a city government, and as an employee, I really feel powerless to make changes from within. And advocates in the community say, why won't you help us do this? And I say, the city council doesn't care what I think. They care what you think. And even though I live in the city and I voted for them to pay taxes there and all that, and I really, I think it really goes back to strong grassroots community-based value statements and pressure asserted on corporations, whether it's a municipal corporation or a privately held corporation, whatever it is. I think government, for example, sees itself as a servant, a public servant. So we're not the ones that lead the charge, we're the ones that serve and do the things that the people in the community want. So I think it goes back to the consumers.
Yes, I think that's a good point. We'll talk a little bit about governments and regulators. It's my view that government has often viewed itself as the servant of business.
Not necessarily a business, but just of
the community. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. Yes?
Related to the whistleblowing, that's something business can do with employees right there is support. I think whistleblowing, I've been involved academically in several cases of whistleblowing, and yes, it's illegal for the employer to retaliate, and yes, it's the right thing to do, and yes, it's becoming more acceptable in society for employees to do such a thing. But it's still a very, very, very difficult thing to do, a very courageous thing to do.
Indeed it is.
And people like that, and they need support. They need support to go for people to go to and help them through that process.
Yeah. Indeed it is. When you blow the whistle, what happens first? You will be attacked.
Yeah.
You're incompetent in doing your job.
You're
malcontent.
Yeah.
And the pressures within a business organization are often, your friends become all of a sudden vacant.
And your job get brought up. You were 5 minutes late. You once told somebody that you were thinking about looking for another job.
Right.
And,
Absolutely. Part of it, though, with respect to being an employee, is to know when to leave an organization, too. If the organization is not responsible, do you want to be affiliated with it? So many young people, I look at Augustana College, affiliate with companies with no due diligence. It's a great job, it's a great paying job, but, what's the ethical fiber of that company? What's the DNA of the company? They don't ask. There's another, yes, in back, please.
What came of the woman who was the whistleblower for Enron?
Well, what was her name?
Magazine woman.
Yeah, I mean, she has really been celebrated due to her whistleblowing.
Did she stay with Enron?
No, I think she was fired, was she not, or forced out of Enron? I tried to get her to come to Augustana College. The lecture fee was too high.
So she's
doing fine. But you know, I think it's a fair comment for every person that does. How did she do? I mean, she did it just right. She knew how to do it. She got the media behind her. She went to the Wall Street Journal in addition to blowing a whistle within the company. She did it right. The rank and file whistleblower. Often is not a
sophisticated in the sport. It doesn't
yeah,
have
right.
That,
yeah.
That PR knowledge to know. To go
that's right. Right. It is a courageous thing to blow the whistle. You're right. Yes.
There were a lot of unions, so you know, one thing employees can do is develop support around themselves, be it through a formal union or any other sort of association with the employees, so that if they do need to do something, they have support. Unions provide that other level of protection, job protection.
Indeed.
Well as attorneys and people who will go and fight for you, and the company will immediately not fire you or do that stuff because they don't want to get caught on it. But there's a, you know, there's a saying amongst unions that in a non-union shop, that the best way you can help your friends is be a whistleblower, because they're all going to get promoted to say bad things about you.
I think there's a certain amount of truth.
Could I be just a little bit of a devil's advocate and ask how many, in the last 20 years, how many union members have become too cozy with the management of the company so that even there,
I'm sure there's plenty of that also. Yeah. Good point. We have a few attorneys in the room. I want to ask what attorneys can do. Paul Olson said you'll have three or four attorneys. That was a good prediction of Paul. We have three or four attorneys. What can a corporate attorney do?
Well, the main thing, when we're representing businesses, you know, most of them obey the laws. That's not the issue.
Right.
The biggest thing we can do is we have access to senior management. And so we're at the table and a lot of decisions get made. And actually, especially as you get older in the practice, you're looked to much more as an advisor.
Right.
Actually, you're actually in the wisdom business at the end of your career.
Yeah.
And that's an important role you have, because you can take MICA 6-8 to the boardroom, and you actually can use the word justice, although lawyers have to be careful. Most lawyers never use the word justice in any context.
Right. Isn't that interesting?
And it's true. And I think you can, when you're talking about any business, you actually pose the question, what's the right thing to do? Maybe not quite use the word justice, but you can put it to people on the list of you. And that's probably the, at least from a corporate lawyer standpoint, the best thing.
Yes.
He said a couple things today. One is to not wear your religion on your sleeve, but to let it be known who you are, what your background is. And I think various others of us will have different opportunities. Oftentimes the attorney can get things done because who he is, but also the relationship and trust that he's built up with the corporation or the board, and they're looking for advice because they have a trust relationship that's built up and they know who this person is. And I think that kind of can carry some persuasion and dialogue that can be effective. But I often think too that so many of us are so concerned about what can we do? Can we be the whistleblower? Can we be this? But oftentimes it's little things and who you are, and do have an opportunity as an employee to serve on a committee that's doing something and build this a little bit and not be in a hurry, but oftentimes things get done by the drip, drip, drip. And that's why I love the comment earlier on is let know who you are, because I think the opportunities, be they big or small, will come if you're looking for them to join a service club, and those service clubs sometimes have the opportunity to sit across a lunch table with somebody who's a CEO somewhere, and it's these little things, and I'm always in a hurry to get things done, but good things usually take a lot of failure, but keeping at it, but they know who you are, and they build up that trust, I think you're going to be effective.
I practiced law while I taught in the state of Montana for a few years, and I remember going to a legal seminar, and the general counsel of Montana Power Corporation, which was kind of vilified in the state of Montana, saying, I'm the number one environmental lawyer in the state of Montana. Now, Montana has a great Sierra Club organization and so on, and I talked to him afterwards about that, talked to her afterwards about that, And she said, I used my position to make it clear to the company that we're going to comply with the environmental laws, both the letter and the spirit of the environmental laws, because they're two different things. You can comply with the letter, but not the spirit. I think criminal attorneys also have a tremendous leverage in this regard. I think my view is that the criminal prosecution of corporations that violate the law obviously is a good thing, but we're seeing many criminal attorneys now in plea bargaining deals with corporations, particularly when there's some individual liability, saying that the penalty is going to be lower if you adopt a better code of corporate responsibility. Excellent example of that was Tyson Foods. A few years ago, you know, Tyson was in all sorts of trouble for illegal campaign contributions, price fixing, and so on. They paid some very hefty fines with respect to their conduct, but part of the settlement with the Department of Justice is that you're going to get serious about having a code of responsibility, whistleblower, a program, a compliance officer. A friend of mine was hired, law professor, as compliance officer for Tyson Foods. I wouldn't have his job for $1 million. That was a tough job to have. But in his view, it was taken very seriously because they were under the supervision of the United States Department of Justice. And if you did not comply, if you made light of this compliance officer, perhaps someone was going to jail next time around. So I think attorneys can do a lot. Let me ask about advocacy organizations. How can advocacy organizations be effective?
That seems like they can do that media spotlight thing.
Certainly the media spotlight thing. I will tell you, based on my knowledge of corporations are sensitive to what the media has to say. And organizations that are savvy and careful with respect to media relations and do their homework can make a real difference. I also think advocacy organizations or nonprofit organizations in many ways can look for ways to align their interest with the interest of corporations. I'll never forget the law school I was at, Capital University Law School, was a block down from the first Wendy's restaurant. First in Columbus, Ohio, the first Wendy's restaurant ever on Broad Street. It's kind of a museum. So after 18 months of trying, I got an appointment with Dave Thomas, at the time the founder and moving force. And I said, Dave, wouldn't it be great? You know, we're moving this new law school to downtown Columbus, one block from your restaurant. We're revitalizing the restaurant. Wouldn't it be great to have your name above the law school? And Dave Thomas School of Law at Capital University. He said, lawyers have made my life miserable. I'll never do that. But he said, my passion since I was adopted is to get kids out of child care into permanent and loving homes. And in the end, partnered with Capital University Law School and founded the National Center for Adoption Law to figure out ways to speed up adoptions and to develop model statutes. So advocacy organizations can also look for intersections. What the Gates family has done has been tremendous, and we've seen that repeated. That's often not with the corporate treasury, but individual wealth. There are a tremendous number of ways for advocacy organizations to partner in a friendly basis with business or business owners, or if that doesn't work, to use the media. Let me ask you about the young people that are idealistic and want to engage in some form of civil disobedience. Does that make a difference?
Depends how strategically they do it.
I think that's a good answer. It depends upon how strategically they do it. My nephew, my nieces, both nephew and niece are very impassioned about this, and some of you are from Des Moines. She was concerned about the practices of Staples. So she chained herself to the front door of Staples to protest the fact that they had very little recycled content in much of the paper that they sold. I've often asked myself, did it make much difference? Now, when you do something like that, it's like blowing the whistle. because Staples claims she, you know, obstructed the, she wouldn't obstruct the entrance to the place. She was handing out informational brochures, but the article in the paper was a Grinnell College student arrested for obstructing the Staples entrance. You need to be very strategic if you are going to do that. But I believe that there is a role for that. If done strategically and done well, we can work the media. Now, she has gone on into a career of a professional organization against irresponsible corporations. She's taking on Coca-Cola now. So she got to do a little community service in the city of Des Moines, but at the same time, she may have made a difference for a few consumers passing through those doors, but made a huge difference for herself and gained a passion. Other things that we might do. Yes, let me take your comment and then your comment, please. In back, please.
Well, I think there also is some shifting going on in the general field of leadership development around awareness of the common, the importance of the common good.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking of the Kennedy School and the work of John Heifetz. All of that has this focus that it's not just about the bottom line or about me, but it's about how we manage together.
Yes, good point. You know, if you look at the finest MBA programs in the nation, there certainly has been a shift in the last 20 years for more focus on corporate responsibility, particularly sustainability of corporations, and that is, of course, tied to environmental sustainability. As I look at each of the professions in the room here, there are tremendous opportunities, pastors, educators, community advocates. Other things that I've missed that we might do, yes, Jane?
You commented in your handout about the internet. I was wondering if you talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. I think the internet, you ought to type in when you get home, worst corporations in America on Google. And you'll bring up hundreds of websites. There are hundreds of those individuals out there that are monitoring corporate conduct and making their findings available via the internet. Does that make any difference, do you think, to corporations?
They don't like to see their name there, I'm sure. That's,
well, yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of people who
are. My guess is that it does. There are tens of organizations that try to rate colleges and say what's good and bad, and our PR people surf those things, what's being said, and when there's a negative, it does. You don't like it. It's like it's in the newspaper, but it's freely available. So I think the internet is a very, very good place. What about consumers? Let's ask about consumers. Is there anything that the consumers ought to do?
You mentioned yesterday, I think, something about we need to think about a change in our values culture. And to me, that's one of the most important things that you can talk about. People talk to me about mistreatment of the agricultural workers in California, for example. And I'm not quarreling that that's a problem, but I do say to them, how much are you contributing to that? You buy fresh tomatoes in Minneapolis in the wintertime,
mm-hmm.
and how much are you paying those guys who pick those tomatoes? But if, do you want to be able to still buy those at three times the price if they pay what they ought to pay? And that's, of course, I'm old enough that I didn't eat fresh tomatoes in the wintertime, so we had a can. But there are things like that. Our values culture just really has to be addressed before we can do as much as we ought to do.
Do consumers make a difference? Do you think boycotts make a difference? Oh, sure. Sure they do. Sure they do. I mean, the margin of profitability for many consumer companies, if sales are down by 5%, that could be the margin of profitability. How do we act, though, as responsible consumers? As we're at Walmart, how do we act? Yeah. Yes?
This isn't about Walmart, although that's a choice in where you shop. But I recently tried to file a complaint with the Better Business Bureau about some unethical business practices of the company I was dealing with, and they really weren't interested in that nature completely. It was more like if there's some financial spin to it, if they had cheated me or not delivered on the goods or something, then they would accept the claim. But if there was a human rights violation or any sort of qualitative thing,
Sure, sure.
I'm wondering, do you know anything about?
Well, of course, the Better Business Bureau is funded by business, and the Better Business Bureau is objective is to kind of weed out the bad businesses that engage in financial fraud and so on. But wouldn't it be wonderful if associations or chambers of commerce would do something in the area of social responsibility also? Let me ask, though, before we close, about consumers. What can you do as consumers?
Don't buy an SUV.
Unless it's a hybrid.
Unless you're going to call about six people around it.
Yeah.
Or as Chuck said, if you're 6'5", you have a hard time getting around on a rabbit. So, I mean,
yeah.
You know, that's when you buy a convertible.
There you go.
You know, I have a bit of a problem with this don't buy their argument, though. I mean, not that I totally disagree with it. Like Walmart. My wife goes by diapers at Walmart, and she buys them there because they're cheaper. And quite frankly, right now, we're a one-income family, and that's the closest place where they're cheap. And we make a joke about it every time about how people shouldn't shop at Walmart. But the fact of the matter is if you don't shop at those places, those people won't just have a crappy job. They won't have a job at all. So is that a better alternative? And so I think about that sometimes when I hear that. Should we just not shop there at all, and then those people won't? You know, but maybe I'm
But you will shop somewhere.
Yeah.
You have to buy your diaper somewhere. So
yeah, well, but there's not very good places left to do that.
Paul?
Just for your information, there's a wonderful video in the village called The High Price of Low Costs. The High Cost of Low Prices, it is. And it's about Walmart and other box kind of stores. And then just also some information, I think it's on the bulletin board on the east end here, of how Holden goes about buying its food. They look carefully at the labor practices. They look carefully at the fertilizing and chemical practices. And from those people, I mean, the food you're eating, we're eating at Holden, has been studied. Those are consumer, that's consumer responsibility.
I think there's two sides of the consumer thing. One, you may not go to a Walmart, and that's not going to affect your Walmart because you don't go, because 8,000 other people are going through the door every hour, but it's for you. So it's sort of keeping track of our own soul. And then there's sort of organized consumer actions, and I was surprised how much an organized consumer action around since our country's full of chains now, which I used to bemoan, but now I realize if you organize an action against a chain in your community, the whole national corporate infrastructure gets involved, and all of a sudden people from New York start showing up in your town.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of levels of what we can do. Certainly for those of us responsible, as I am for our bookstore and the Augustana merchandise, we contract with a buying group that screens where we buy from. Now, it's interesting. As a result, the prices are about 50% higher, but we feel we do the right thing. The student organizations, as Paul knows, go out and get their own T-shirts at two-thirds of the cost. Secondly, there are a number of great websites. The ELCA website, if you search for corporate responsibility, will link you through the corporate responsibility page to the World Watch Institute that has done a lot of this analysis for us with respect to our buying habits. What should we look out for? And most major purchases are listed there. So I think there are some things we can do. I'm a little concerned, though, about the argument that was made here. It is one thing to say for those of us who are middle class and above, here are the places to buy. That's a little tougher for the one income family, the minimum wage person, and so on. I don't have the answer to that, but a lot of that which happens.
Well, we struggle with it.
Yeah.
We would like to go to places and say, well, what are the ethical, what are the labor laws on? We would like to ask those questions, but at the same time, you got to make an economic decision. I mean, do I pay more to go here? And it's come to that at times when you have just one income. And it's difficult. We struggle with that more question. And the way we handle it is we only buy what we absolutely need to buy from.
Yeah. Yeah.
The community we're in, that's a hard thing to do because there's not very many places to go.
Let's take three more questions before we close. Yes, sir, and then in back, and then over here.
How does the lobbying industry fit into all this kind of thing? I'm a part of a voluntary organization who has decided that if they're going to have an impact on world hunger, they need somebody inside the Beltway. and they have to open an office in there, and is there some organization that looks at lobbying and how it, the impact it has on all this stuff?
I don't know whether there is. There probably is. That is a very, very good question. I know that Augustana College, for example, hired a lobbyist finally. I thought long and hard about that, to advocate for proper funding in higher education with other lobbyists, and then to argue also for some of our special initiatives at Augustana. It's been highly effective. Skilled lobbyists can make a difference, indeed. It is a business that I'm still trying to understand. It's a business that I have some ethical issues with. I think it's a very good question. I wish I had a better answer for you. In back there?
This isn't a question. It's more just some information to consider, especially in response to a couple points you raised about shopping at Walmart. First of all, whether it's really low cost. Couple things. Many, many studies all around the country have demonstrated that when Walmart comes in, many locally owned small businesses close. So it's not really a matter of different jobs, but the jobs transfer, and sometimes the jobs pay less. And the less money stays in your economy. A locally owned business typically returns 3 to 4 times as much money to your local economy as a nationally based business that's sending most of its profits and contracts out of town. In Washington State, the largest group of employees, people who are working, are Walmart employees. They're the largest group that are receiving state subsidized health care, child care, and food stamps. So the low cost that you pay at Walmart isn't really an overall low cost. It's you're paying for it in other ways, in your taxes and things.
That's a very good argument.
You know, just to build on that argument, I watch locally how governments do backflips to get organizations to relocate into their community, tax incentives and so on. We ought to be a little savvy about that. If we give tax incentives, we're investors in that business. We ought to ask what they're going to give back. We ought to ask what the code of responsibility is. I don't see a lot of that happening. Let's take one more comment, and then for those of you who desire to remain around for informal conversation, we can.
One thing that seems to me to be an item that would level the playing field would be more regulation of business, so that all businesses would have to adhere to similar practices as far as hiring or pay scale, so that we don't have Walmart employees on welfare. But ironically, it seems like at least a number of politicians are saying, no, we should deregulate business, and why should the government be telling each of us how we can spend our money? Let's deregulate it and let the free enterprise system work. It just seems
That's a very, very, very good point. Deregulate business, let Adam Smith's invisible hand work. Well, Adam Smith's invisible hand doesn't work in the United States, because the obligation of the corporation is to return a maximum return to shareholders. So to expect corporations by themselves to act in a socially responsible way, it's too much to expect. Well, I want to thank you for your kind attention. I'll be around for a discussion afterwards. For those of you who will be here next week, we're going to talk about some of these topics in a little more detail. We're going to talk in detail about corporate codes of ethics, looking at which ones are good, which ones are bad, how we can influence corporations to have good codes of ethics. We're going to take a greater look at ELCA work on shareholders' resolutions, think about some shareholders' resolutions that we might create ourselves and work with groups like the ELCA to advance. We're also going to look at the problem of plantation labor. By that, I mean corporations going into third world countries where there is very little regulation of fair labor rates, environmentalism, and ask what our responsibilities are when we go into third world countries and what we can learn. So for those of you who are not leaving, we'll get into more detail next week. And thank you for your discussion. I've learned a lot from you. Thank you.